Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas in our series, Pandemic Psychodynamics. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Stephen D'Souza from London, UK. Stephen is an author and co-author of four books, most recently, Not Knowing with Diana Renner, which won the UK Management Book of the Year. Stephen's also been Associate Fellow at Said Business School, the University of Oxford, and currently heads up Executive Development for a global organization. Stephen is also a trained analytic network coach. Stephen, you're very welcome. How are you?
Thanks, Simon. I'm delighted to be on the podcast and to have this conversation with you. Excited what will happen between us.
I was interested in what's going on in the UK. I was born and brought up in the UK and now I live in Ireland. So tell me, give me a snapshot of how things are for you and what you're observing over there.
Yeah, it's we were talking before the actual podcast. It's a funny thing to be a representative of a nation. You know, how often I, as growing up from an Asian background, my parents from Goa, was thought to be representing, you know, minority groups. Here, representing countries is a much bigger ask. So what I can do is just share my own perspective, always from that narrow field of view. But my own experiences, you know, there's a lot of varied emotions and it's reflective of everywhere, really. And so probably how I am is what I'll notice. But I do see the fatigue among many people with the extended lockdown. We're now entering the eighth week here in the UK. So yeah. I think people are looking, are we exiting? If so, how do we exit? So it's about either returning to a new normal, or let's say returning to a better normal or a worse than it was before. And nobody's quite sure what that return looks like, even if it is a return, and we can question that maybe in our conversation. There's still a lot of fear, but I think that fear has mostly turned to fatigue. As you know, for example, we built a hospital, I think had 4,000 beds, the Nightingale Hospital. It wasn't used to that extent, and I think they've repurposed it again. The same ventilators, you know, there was a lot of catastrophic thinking, we won't have enough. They asked UK companies to make them. They, for example, Dyson, headquartered in Singapore now, was contracted to make many of them, actually now cancelled the order. So there's, I guess, a sense of relief that we haven't seen what they were predicting. At the same time, still that sense of fear, it's there, but fear turned into fatigue and wondering what will happen next. Will we see a new wave? Will we see other things? And this not knowing that we're now very clear, but still looking to our leaders to provide authority, to provide clarity, direction, protection. And almost that impossible task that we're placing on our politicians in particular.
Yeah, I mean, that's my sense, that this fatigue, there's when something like this breaks out, there's a kind of defensive reaction, there's a kind of activism, people jump onto Zoom mania and they build hospitals and they kind of do lots of things very, very quickly. And then there's a kind of a second phase I think we enter, and I think we're in that phase now, and it is fatigue, and it touches on your books about not knowing, which I'm interested to kind of hear about, because we really are perhaps more than ever in a period of not knowing. So can you speak to that, what your books are about and how that kind of relates to this COVID situation?
Sure, Simon. So the central premise of not knowing is that we live in a society that privileges knowledge and that privileges expertise, and that due to the complexity of the environment, and it was always complex, but that it's more evident of the complexity now with the growth of information, etc., that it is impossible for anybody to know And so in the past, whereas we tended to look at heroic leaders to provide solutions, now we're finding ourselves that with leaders that don't have the answers, and it's challenging. So the example in not knowing is that we use a metaphor from the Camino de Santiago, the ancient pilgrimage from France to Spain. And if you walked 90 kilometers more to the coast, you would reach a coastal town called Finisterre in Latin, the end of the earth. And on the old maps, the cartographers used to draw lions and sea dragons because it was terrifying. Sailors would go and they wouldn't necessarily return. And that's what it feels like right now. It feels like we're at the edge. There's Finisterre, not just once, but many times. And this return to the edge and this feeling of groundlessness. So what we looked at was, how do you normally react at the edge? So we all have our defaults, as you said, in this case of the COVID-19 and pandemic. Maybe there was a rush to control. Maybe the default was the catastrophic thinking. Maybe it was, you know, let's say analysis. Let's get the experts in from Imperial and crunch the data. But there's a variety of responses, and not all of them are conscious. Many of them, as you say, are informed by unconscious routines and practices. But the idea here is not to pathologize them, you know, not to say catastrophic thinking is incorrect and in some way deviant. And because obviously the cost is, it puts us in panic, stress is raised, we worry over Julie. But the positive side is that we are prepared if the worst does happen. You know, there's that saying, only the paranoid survive. So the same with all of these things. The quick action, yes, it could be misaction because it could be seen as the quick fix that doesn't solve the problem, but creates a wicked problem. But the benefit is it may be better than having taking no action until it's perfect. So the idea is recognizing what the default is and being able to work with that in a more conscious way, and to share that, recognizing what our shared assumptions are and our shared collective behavior versus just the individual as well. So I'll pause there and I'll talk about not knowing in the broader context, but just keen on your thoughts into some of these patterns that you've noticed and from your perspective in Ireland, or this, you're speaking with your listeners from other places.
Yeah, well, I've been speaking to colleagues from Moscow, Australia, States, India. And it's been very interesting. There's clearly shared patterns of kind of behavior. And of course, there's difference as well. But I mean, the shared patterns, I think, are these unconscious processes, how we manage our anxieties. Mm. And how we manage anxiety just seems to be fundamental to how this is kind of dealt with. So like what I noticed in the British kind of political media was the amount of kind of talk of kind of war. And of course, today is VE Day in the UK. There's a holiday for the end of World War II. And just this kind of analogy of war, kind of, so that's like an unconscious default. That's kind of where quite a lot of kind of male leaders go to. And what that does to kind of our reactions, really. I think it's very interesting. And then there's other kind of places where people manage their anxiety in a more contained way. And it allows them to think and I think produce more collaborative kind of results. So this kind of emerging kind of fear, which leads to kind of denial or activism or kind of reactions or at worst attacking marginal groups, splitting off our kind of our fears and projecting them onto other people is kind of clearly happening. There's a warning today from the World Health Organization about how much marginal groups are getting attacked across the globe. So there's all these kind of unconscious reactions and kind of patterns of behavior which kind of get magnified. Somebody wrote today in the New York Times that COVID's not a great leveler, it's a great magnifier. And I think that's very true. That kind of resonated with me. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I share this similar point of view, and I've noticed the metaphors. You know, the war on is a very popular metaphor, and we've used it for a long time, whether it's the war on drugs or the war on terrorism, which doesn't seem to work. Another metaphor that I've noticed come up a lot in the pandemic is the metaphor of it's a marathon and not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And this idea of continually being prepared and continually being on the edge almost. And I'm not sure whether it's a metaphor of endurance what's the metaphor of renewal, metaphor of resilience. So I think they're very different things. So I wonder if we're just being asked to endure and longer, or we're being invited to actually rethink how we're doing things. And yes, I've seen more polarity, the scapegoating that you mentioned, with finding a them to blame as a way to take back control. And I wonder how we'll see this resurgence of control actually in society. So you've seen that there's been a grab almost on democracy, with more monitoring in countries such as China, countries such as Turkey, countries such as Russia, and a taking away of freedoms that we took for granted. And that may be the same also in the UK. I was speaking, some people will talk about companies where they're enforcing temperature checks, for example, or they'll be doing looking at remote virtual working, but monitoring that remotely. So we wonder what type of world we're entering into. And this is not being catastrophic, but it's thinking that perhaps we can't go back to the way things were. So what are the ways forward that are emerging right now? And what's our perspective as consultants, as coaches, psychologists, that we can bring to raise awareness around this?
Yeah. I mean, one of my concerns in my books over the years has been about a rising kind of authoritarianism and conformism in corporate life. I write about corporate fundamentalism, that there's a kind of a lot of language which kind of covers up what's really going on. So we talk about kind of freedom and choice, but there's been a shift in my lifetime, I think, of kind of a more autonomous, rebellious, kind of questioning kind of society to a much more conformist one. And it's showing up politically with kind of people in the West choosing populist leaders, you know, in America, in Europe, and it's kind of almost like choosing some kind of prohibition. And this COVID has kind of really opened the door for more of that. I'm kind of interested in kind of the dangers that poses, and whether we can be awake enough to see that whilst we're at this edge, there's also huge opportunities for creating something new. Without going back to some kind of authoritarian kind of modelling or prohibitive modelling, which I think is quite dangerous at this moment.
Yeah, I agree. It's sort of almost co-opted resistance. And so, for example, think back just at the beginning of the last decade in terms of all the movements such as Occupy, the Arab Spring, all those fermenting movements that we saw people no longer tolerating the existing present. Yet what I've noticed with the COVID is almost like a shaming of those that have different views, such as want to debate the balance of health to democracy and freedom. In some way, they're shut down. You know, it's only seen as a public health discourse and not a discourse on freedoms, rights, responsibilities, and choices. And it's not the issue in themselves, but the fact that the debate is shut down. And obviously that gives rise to a whole lot of conspiracy theories and alternative ways, as you say, of resistance and ways of managing that anxiety when the debate cannot be happened out in the open. So I think this is something that we need to be watchful of in the coming years as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's phrases used which kind of silence people. So the politicians stand up and they say, "We follow science. Science says." I'm like, who can argue with science? That's facts, isn't it? You know. But as we know, that science speaks with many different voices, and then there's many different types of science, and kind of different people interpret science differently. And power play always takes place as well. Who's kind of making the decisions on kind of on what basis? But there's these kind of umbrella terms which do silence people, which I think we have to be very wary of.
And, yeah, I noticed that a lot as well in the world of work, Simon. So there's a rise of their term evidence-based.
Yes.
And it's almost like presented as if evidence is neutral.
Yes, that's right.
It's, this is evidence-based. Therefore, any alternative point of view is nonsense, essentially. And so this idea that what we propose and what we select as evidence is neutral, I think, needs to be start to be challenged. Now, we're not talking, you know, we've seen the rise of, with Trump, of alternative facts. So this whole idea of, you know, anything that contradicts an opinion is said to be fake or fake news, etc. So how do we have a more balanced discussion about utility and not ignore the dynamics of power, not ignore what do we count as evidence, rather than seeing everything as neutral or in black and white, as you say, or as it's portrayed as for some purpose. So this is another interesting phenomenon, how that discourse is also within the use of, in organizations as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's been very very much so in organizations, and I think there's just a lack of critical thinking which goes on. I mean, I work with very bright people, bright leaders, like, you know, really super bright people. But I do notice that quite often that there's a lack of critique of really being able to kind of question this and think about kind of how evidence is used, how kind of numbers are used. And, you know, we've known for a long time that numbers can be used in all sorts of different ways, depending on kind of who's using them, and that there's not this neutrality. And I think Trump's kind of and the populist kind of fake news thing is kind of problematized that really their claim that kind of experts don't matter, Michael Gove kind of said that a few years ago, it kind of really kind of opens up a kind of a chasm which we kind of people fall into, and it's kind of either there is experts and facts or there's not experts and facts, you know, and if there's not, then you're on the Trump side, you know. And that's what we've got to kind of navigate, really, kind of somewhere in between where we actually really question how power is used. Well, power is not talked about enough, I don't think, because how people kind of use evidence and for their own political ends, and how kind of it's used in business for certain reasons has to be questioned, I think. It's kind of absolutely kind of essential.
Yeah, no, I agree. This whole emphasis that you quoted Gove, I think there's been that return, like the evidence base, a return to seeing the doctor or the scientist as the expert to provide direction, as you're pointing out. But we've seen it in wider movements as well, for example, in climate change, how Greta has been on the receiving end of a lot of projection on, in a sense, the voice of the child being providing direction, providing hope. So it's the same type of projection onto an authority, onto a voice. And we have to question why, what's happening. I'm intrigued, Simon, by your own experience in Lacan and this whole concept of how we take pleasure in our displeasure, in our symptoms. So when you view the pandemic from that lens, I'm curious to find out how you're viewing it through a Lacanian lens, particularly in taking pleasure from the displeasure that we're now experiencing with an extended lockdown.
Yeah, well, I'm really thinking a lot about it, because one Lacanian view is that we moved from a society of prohibition in the 1950s, where we respected authority figures, we respected the monarchy, we respected the kind of the police and the institutions, and politicians were held in higher esteem. And the society of prohibition said no, is like the pleasure people got were through transgressing prohibition. So like having premarital sex was exciting, and kind of that's how people kind of transgressed the law of the father. And we then moved to a society of commanded enjoyment, where the kind of post-1968 Cultural Revolution opened up a kind of a space where individual freedom was regarded as the most important thing, our own happiness, self-awareness, personal insight. And it was all about kind of, it kind of produced almost a narcissistic society. And now suddenly the door has been slammed shut on that. And people were wondering kind of how would the Brits kind of put up with a lockdown? You know, if we do it too early, they're going to kind of go crazy. And actually people across the globe on the whole have been quite amenable to kind of this very severe, you cannot leave your house. It's kind of a very kind of extraordinary kind of thing. And there's a part of us, I think, which kind of likes prohibition. There's a part of us likes a father telling us what to do, a kind of an authority figure. I say father because it's kind of the psychoanalytic kind of language from Freud, but it's really kind of an authority figure, and it can be kind of male or female. And people kind of get some pleasure out of that. They kind of complain about it, but they quite enjoy it because it gives them some sense of kind of security. And it creates this kind of splitting as well, where we split off kind of our own fears and anxieties, and we project them onto others, so that the leader can kind of manage them for us, or the kind of marginalized group. So there's a kind of pleasure in, and almost like I said before this happened, there was this kind of people were actually choosing more authoritarian leaders anyway, kind of in parts of the world, people who were the most dispossessed perhaps.
Yeah, I'm really curious about this, the use of the word father and in terms of authority. And what I've noticed in the media, there's a lot of splitting between the different leadership responses to the pandemic, in that I've seen more emphasis on women leaders being almost held up as exemplars by excellence of handling the pandemic, as contrasted to male leaders. So look at the Prime Minister of New Zealand, for example, or Jacinda Ardern, or you look at Angela Merkel, or, and you see how did they respond, and almost like talking about a different kind of leadership that was shown. So whereas men may have resorted to science, but more authoritarian, the language of war, there was a difference in the way, let's say, the mother as a figure responded. Any comments or any views or perspectives on that, Simon, in terms of that splitting between gendered response by leaders?
I'm very wary of gender splitting, because it can be very essentialist. You know, women are more collaborative, men are more kind of doers. There's, and that language does get into psychoanalysis a lot, which is problematic, I think. I do think that there's a certain kind of socially constructed male who acts out machismo. I think that's a social construction which has been around for a long time. And we often see it in kind of gung-ho leaders like Trump or Boris. You know, we can get through this. We can break through. Just open up the country. Yes. And I think, I don't think it's gender specific, you know, because I also remember female leaders such as Maggie Thatcher, who were in no way seen as kind of a soft collaborative leaders. They kind of had their own kind of sense of doing. So I don't think it's gender specific, but I do think that kind of how we socially construct gender does kind of shape leadership and followership, kind of what we expect from our leaders. And I think Merkel and other women leaders can lean towards kind of being more collaborative, can be can take on projections which kind of help them be less kind of machismo. So I think it's kind of an interesting, I mean, in Ireland it's interesting, it's a very different kind of we don't have kind of female leaders running the country in the top positions, but it's still a very different rhetoric from the UK rhetoric or the USA rhetoric. I'm kind of interested. So I don't think it's just gender specific, but I do think the way we construct gender is kind of important and is playing out for sure.
What do you see? I mean, you talk about some of the macro perspectives through history, the rise of individualism and the prohibitions. There was almost like actions against prohibition. What do you see as some of the new prohibitions or ways that this will impact society now in terms of those perspectives? To give you an example, there's a wonderful series on Netflix called 1983. I don't know if you've seen it, but it looks at Poland. And it's a fictional work. And the imagination is that the revolution never happened, and the idea that Poland stayed communist. And there's the sense that one of the characters is reading 1984, and he says to his colleague, "And this is a work of fiction?" It was almost like that's accepted now, that there's an interference by the state, that people are, you know, that life is governed or in some way, that, and there's differences in gradients and society. What do you think is your perspective on what we're going to see now, where we've had a much more a rise in localism rising, shaming perhaps for those who question authority in the particular perspectives, that they're not following evidence-based, or of temperature checking, other travel restrictions. I don't know, what are your thoughts on the new prohibitions and the way that you think of this as evolving post-pandemic?
Well, thanks for your question. I think it's. I think we live in dangerous times. I think people on the liberal progressive side of the of politics often kind of point at kind of authoritarian leaders, like clear authoritarian leaders, Orban in Hungary or the Polish kind of leadership, or Trump, and they don't see the splinter kind of in their own eye, where I've written about kind of political correctness and how that's authoritarian as well, because it kind of it limits people's speech, it controls people's speech, and if it controls someone's speech and their discourse, you control their thinking. So people kind of there's authoritarianism coming from different sides. There's authoritarianism coming from our large corporate kind of tech companies, you know, the way Facebook uses our data, how it controls it. It's not just China who's going to kind of control our data. It's kind of the high tech kind of Facebooks as well. And how much do we kind of put up with this? How much do we kind of accept this? And it becomes like a new norm, I think. And this is kind of worrying me. So for me, there's I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but there's going to be a huge struggle, I think. And I hope people are awakened to this kind of struggle, because we kind of sleepwalk into these kind of areas where things become a bit more authoritarian. And like you say, the guy kind of just wakes up one day and says, this is the new normal. This is 1984. So I think people kind of activists and people kind of political thinkers have really got to kind of start asking questions of our corporations, of our authoritarian leaders, and of the kind of the liberal progressive movement, which kind of can be very controlling as well. The environmental movement can be very puritanical in its language and can have a blaming culture. So I think we've got to kind of really kind of fight for kind of an open dialogue, which is basically why I've kind of started this Edu Ideas podcast, because I think these dialogues are absolutely vital.
Yeah, and I get the sense that even as I speak to you, it feels a bit edgy. Now, it can feel like an attack. Of course you should be looking at the evidence. Of course you should be looking at the science. Yeah. Health authorities are impartial, or World Health, and obviously they're not. All organizations have histories, all have vested interests. But the ability to look at this accurately with some clarity, I think, and from different perspectives, as you say, is the value here. So one of the ideas that we talk about not knowing is when we listen to Norita Hertz, she actually wrote a book called Mind Wide Open, or so open. The perspective is, she says, when you listen to experts, when they've done neuroscientific studies of the brain, it's as if the independent decision-making part of our brain shuts down. You know, we just believe everything. Yeah. And Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan, he says, it's never a good idea to take advice from anybody wearing a tie. But he was quipping, but what he was pointing to was how we need to be able to introduce these kind of edgy ideas where we don't feel quite comfortable, and having these debates and these conversations, rather than, as you say, removing them from public discourse, taking down the YouTube video, seeing things as dangerous. But who decides, you know? And even that's a controversial, debatable topic, but we don't have that. We just take something down and we already make our judgments. So yes, freedom is being curtailed. I don't know if we're seen as grown up or responsible enough to make our own choices now, and that we need to be protected, as you say, by father or by mother.
Yeah, I mean, I've been interested in the debate in my mind around social cohesion or social coercion, and how I think to create, you know, the podcast is relating to how do we live the good life and how do we create the good society. And to create the good society, for me, you have to kind of lean towards social cohesion. And that means kind of getting citizens to kind of think and be thoughtful around kind of how they manage lockdowns and how they manage social distancing and physical distancing. And my kind of intuition is to kind of trust people. I'm not naively. I know there's kind of people who and I know people need clear guidelines. I'm not kind of against giving clear guidelines, but I saw some evidence recently which said that the lockdown didn't actually kind of change a lot of things across countries, that the social distancing did, that closing schools did, that kind of closing mass gatherings did. But when I walk along the kind of the promenade in Galway and people are kind of being responsible and kind of they're all out there enjoying the sunshine, but they're all socially distancing, I think that's got to be a good thing for mental health or physical health and kind of balancing these things and allowing some people to kind of make some choices which are very personal and very relevant to them, but kind of not just kind of leading on them with a big stick. And that's kind of what I think is going to be the battle after this, is how we get social cohesion through this.
Yeah, and on the converse side, I think I've never seen such an increase in social cohesion. The whole idea, obviously, we can question what is happening with this clapping for carers, whether it's a displacement or a distraction, a way to feel we're participating in as well as recognizing, but avoiding really issues of funding and other things, or a bit of both, really, acknowledgement, but also displacement. But the one post I saw that was quite funny, and it was just a post somebody made on social media, was that they now, rather than traveling so much and speaking internationally, they've realized with this pandemic they become a hero within 5 miles. And what that means is suddenly they don't need to be somebody, you know, for everybody, but they're beginning to know their neighbor. They're beginning make a difference in their community. They're beginning to do things locally rather than travel or be on the road all the time. And I think that points to this emergence of social cohesion that wasn't there. You know, I saw people standing outside their doors looking at their neighbor for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
And wonderful, rather than being almost like an individual locked up within your home. So there's this sense of seeing each other much more than we have in the past, being delicately talking to strangers. You know, I saw a delivery person just making conversation with somebody rather than just leave their parcel, or checking in with the person serving the coffee. You know, how are you doing? Are you keeping well? Da, da, da. But so there's a delicateness and an interaction, I think, that's happening more now. But the metaphor I use is we tended to think of social distancing, obviously of keeping distance in terms of touch. But we tend to conceive of touch as physical touch, you know, skin to skin. Yet skin isn't something that's bounded in something that's separate, but we can also think of it as porous. We can think of it as interconnected, much wider than something that is like a carrier bag for our skin and for our bones and sinews and organs, but something that actually connects us. So why I'm seeing is this social cohesion, a different way of conceiving how we touch and are touched by each other. Uh-huh. That goes far beyond, you know, the 2 meters and still allows us to connect maybe more so paradoxically than before. So to balance that.
Yeah, no, I share that experience of going out and talking to neighbors and making an effort to smile at somebody because and saying hello when you kind of walk past them with your 2 meter boundary. It has changed things. And I think that's another kind of Lacanian insight, that lack creates desire, and that kind of the prohibition and the lack of being able to go and hug somebody creates a desire to kind of be warm in the ways you're expressing, which I think is very, very helpful.
Mm.
Yes. Have you got any last thoughts, Stephen? Anything you'd like to kind of reflect on from your writings and your work?
At the moment, you know, I've always tried to emphasize the other side to issues. So, for example, I'm not saying knowledge is bad and not knowing it's useful, but when we tend to overemphasize knowledge, when we live in complexity, then it can become dangerous, and we need to embrace our not knowing. And in the same way with the follow-up book to Not Knowing, it was looking at overaction and being almost caught in activity, rather than being able to rest in action and achieve things without pushing and without ignoring the context in which things happen. In terms of the good society, what I'm writing at now is this idea of not being And the idea of not being is being able to see that much of our issues resulting from the idea that we're differentiated and we overemphasize our separateness rather than our cohesion. And we tend to think of our identities as atomized, and we live from that place, and we live from a sense of lack, which Lacan pointed to.
Yeah.
And what I'm differentiating is between personality, or what we know as ego, and being, which doesn't have, is not privatized by an individual, but it's almost like a shared quality that is similar to a space in the room that you're listening to this talk to now. It doesn't have substance. It doesn't, it's not owned by you. It'll be there far after your apartment or house is gone. It accepts what comes into it, doesn't reject anything, but doesn't have to accept it either, but allows. But I'm experimental with this idea that what we need now for a good society is to shift our identity away from only being the personality, the ego, which is necessary, to that wider sense of being, which is shared. And the shared being, I think, doesn't have any lack inside it, and is able, therefore, to relate in a very different way, and tends to be a counter position to excessive growth, excessive desire, as you say, for difference, belong, becoming something. So this is what I'm exploring now, Simon. It's still in infancy, but that's the kind of thing, and its implications for society, its implications for the world of work and for leaders.
I think that's very interesting. I really look forward to your new book whenever it comes out, Stephen. So thank you very much for being a guest on Edge Ideas podcast. It's been really lovely talking to you. Very informative.
Thank you. Likewise, Simon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Edge Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.